From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Hawaii Congresswoman and 2020 Democratic presidential candidate Tulsi Gabbard is in studio.
There are a lot of different issues, a lot of different things that we need to address. There's one issue that's at the core of those investments that we need to make, and that issue is the cost of war.
And we'll take your calls. Also today, the U.S. women's soccer team wins their fourth World Cup.
We're crazy. That's what makes it special. We just have no quit in us. We're so tight, and we'll do anything to win.
And
these children are going to the most glamorous of all summer camps, Camp Mohawk. There's a two-year waiting list, and every child has to be voted in. The question is it worth $1,000 a week?
It sure is.
What's the state of summer camps and summer programs in 2019? It's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. And joining me now in studio is Hawaii Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard. She's a candidate for president in 2020 and just spent the holiday weekend campaigning in New Hampshire. She's also a combat veteran serving two tours in the Middle East. Hello, Congresswoman Gabbard.
Aloha. It's great to be here with you.
We're really happy to have you. Listeners, we also want to hear from you during this segment. What questions do you have for candidate Tulsi Gabbard? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or tweet us at Radio Boston. Heads up, we're also streaming this conversation on Facebook Live, so while you listen, you can watch. Just check out Radio Boston's Facebook page. Congresswoman, it's a crowded field. Now, it may narrow by one today. There's been some word that California Congressman Eric Swalwell may drop out of the race today, but that leaves more than 20 candidates. So why are you running?
The most important responsibility that the president has is to serve as commander-in-chief. I'm prepared to do that job on day one. Go back to the experience that I have of serving in Congress over 6 years on the Foreign Affairs, the Armed Services, as well as the Homeland Security Committees, as well as serving as a soldier for over 16 years in the Army National Guard. I deployed twice to the Middle East. The first deployment was to Iraq in 2005 during the height of the war, where I served in a medical unit and where every single day I was confronted with the very high human cost of war. So through all of these experiences, I know the importance of our national security. I know the importance of keeping the American people safe and the high human cost of war. These experiences equip me and allow me to be able to walk in on day one on the Oval Office, prepared to fulfill that responsibility of commander-in-chief to end these wasteful regime change wars, this new Cold War we're in with escalating tensions between the U.S. and other nuclear-armed countries, and to end this nuclear arms race. All of these things that have been taking trillions of dollars out of our taxpayers' pockets, going to pay for these wasteful wars, and instead redirecting those precious resources into serving the very real and urgent needs of people in communities all across the country. Things like healthcare, quality education, a new green energy economy, protecting our planet. We have pressing needs that need to be addressed. And only by making this change, by dealing with the cost of war, will we have those resources we need to invest in our people, invest in our communities.
Congresswoman, you refer regularly to the new Cold War and
yes,
the new nuclear arms race. So who are the parties in this new Cold War and who is engaged in this nuclear arms race?
Primarily what we're seeing are escalating tensions between the United States and Russia, as well as China, and we continue to face a nuclear threat from North Korea. These tensions are things that we have to take seriously because, as nuclear strategists have pointed out numerous times, especially recently, we're facing a greater threat of nuclear war than ever before. This is something that may be hard to grasp for some folks, but it's something that we had a huge wake-up call in Hawaii last year when we thought we were under attack. We thought that there was a nuclear missile coming in towards us. We got that alert on over a million phones across our state,
which turned out to be a false alarm, but said that it wasn't.
Exactly. It turned out to be a false alarm. But I tell you, we got that alert that said incoming ballistic missile to Hawaii, seek immediate shelter. This is not a drill. And so as that alert went across all of these phones and alarms started going off, sirens were blaring, it was terrifying. We had college kids who were sprinting across campus. They got the text message that said, seek immediate shelter. And they're running in all directions saying, where do we go? Where do we find shelter? We had a parents who, a father lowered his little 7 or 8 year old girl down a manhole thinking that that may be the only place she could find shelter. But the sick reality is there's no shelter. There's no shelter for us and our families and loved ones in Hawaii. But just as you and I are sitting here today in this studio, if we got that alert right now, where would you go?
Yeah.
That is the harsh reality that we're facing, and really the hoax that has been placed before us, really due to a failure of leadership, that we have these ever escalating tensions. And yes, this is coming from Democratic leaders as well as President Trump and his administration in the White House, and Republicans escalating these tensions, sparking off this nuclear arms race without thinking through what the consequences are. Either they're not thinking it through or they don't care. Both are absolutely unacceptable. And so for me, going through that experience in Hawaii last year was a pivotal event in eventually driving me to make this decision to run for president, to make it so that no person, no child, no family in this country would have to go through what we went through, so that we can work towards a future where we can live free from fear of an imminent nuclear attack.
Hawaii Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard, 2020 presidential candidate. We're going to stay on foreign policy, but I just quickly want to come back to listeners. Call in. Let us know your questions for the congresswoman and the candidate. It's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. Let's talk about Iran.
Yes.
Your experiences in the Middle East seem to shape your view of both intervention in general and our current policy towards Iran. You've expressed grave concern that a war there would outstrip the cost that we paid for the Iraq War.
By far.
So, you actually spoke pretty strongly about this during the Democratic debates when you referred to the president's cabinet as a chicken hawk cabinet. But today, Vice President Mike Pence said, hey, we don't want war, but we're not going to back down. So I guess the question is, what do you think the administration should be doing now to move to de-escalation and some kind of resolution?
Yeah, well, this is an important thing to address. And I think for us and for your listeners, the American people, to look at the words that are coming from Vice President Pence. President Trump has also said he doesn't want a war with Iran. But the reality is their actions are moving us closer and closer to the brink of war with Iran. So really the question is for voters in this country to decide what speaks louder, what means more. Is it the words that they're saying or the actions that they and their administration are pursuing? And it is clearly Trump's actions. With people like Secretary Pompeo and John Bolton, who have, through tearing up the Iran nuclear deal, through increasing and escalating these crippling sanctions on Iran and their economy, even though they were complying with the Iran nuclear deal, further sending more and more U.S. troops to the region, as well as declaring Iran's military as a terrorist organization, something that is unprecedented around the world. This has never happened before, with Secretary Pompeo actually saying that the head of the Iranian military, the IRGC, he sees them as the very same as ISIS.
So you're saying it's never happened before because this is a sovereign government?
This is a sovereign government's military. And so the fact that this administration declared their military as a terrorist organization, to me, leads us to the logical outcome where this administration is looking to be able to wage a war with Iran without congressional authorization. And this is something they're already saying, well, Iran is working with al-Qaeda. Where have we heard that before?
And so you think that is to give cover to act without congressional authorization?
Exactly. This is something that we heard in the Iraq War. This was the lie that was told to us as service members, as soldiers, was told to the American people to get people to agree to go to war with Iraq. And this is what we need to understand in the American people, how we were betrayed then. We were lied to then. Many of us believe those lies then. We cannot allow ourselves to be tricked into another war now that, as we said, would prove far more costly, far more devastating than anything we saw in the Iraq War.
We have a call. So we have Teddy from Medford. Teddy, what question do you have for the Congresswoman?
How's it going, Congresswoman? Thanks for having me, WBUR. My question for you is, because of the recent flare-ups and tensions between India and Pakistan, do you think the United States should play a role in brokering a deal? And in what way would you try to broker a deal between those two parties?
Thanks, Teddy. Thanks for your question. As we talk about the nuclear threat and the consequences of a nuclear bomb being used, these tensions you're bringing up between India and Pakistan are very relevant. As we saw that recent kind of skirmish and heightening tensions occurring, that was the great concern that I had, given they are both nuclear-armed countries, and that if one of them chose to use those weapons, this is not something that would be contained within those two countries. We would then see a nuclear winter that would come about as a result of that beginning of that nuclear war, a nuclear winter that would, you know, kill off the crops. It would end up killing not just millions of people, but billions of people.
So how do you...
Well, this is where, I mean, the United States can and should, because we have relationships with both countries, try to help shape a resolution, reconciliation, but also not being naive to the longstanding conflict that has existed between these two countries. The issues there are complex, but I think the United States can help to play a role by working with both countries to try to de-escalate those tensions and continue to encourage them not to resort to nuclear war.
Listeners, join Teddy from Medford in asking Congresswoman and presidential candidate Tulsi Gabbard your question at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's talk about Syria. We'll stay on foreign policy. Let's talk about Syria. It's well known that you went to Syria and visited with or had a meeting with President Bashar al-Assad in 2017. You've also questioned reports of Assad using chemical weapons. What would it take for you to conclude that Assad used chemical weapons in Syria? And if you did conclude that he had, would that stop you from meeting with him again?
Well, a couple of points here. First of all, there is a process that exists to determine through the United Nations and eventually through the International Criminal Court the evidence, the investigations, and ultimately the prosecution of those who use these weapons in the ICC. I think we as a country and the global community need to recognize and support that process in taking place. So the UN itself and their organization responsible for chemical weapons investigations have cast doubt on previous reports about chemical weapons attacks.
But
that
precipitated
the use of military force by the United States. We've seen those reports come out from the OPCW questioning previous evidence that had put in place, and there have been extensive reports by a professor, Ted Postel, from MIT here in Massachusetts, again, pointing to the evidence or the lack thereof. The bottom line for us here is I am skeptical. I am skeptical anytime someone claims that there is evidence that will precipitate a U.S. military attack.
Because, so let's take out the U.S. military attack component.
Well,
because
according
to a 2019 study from the Berlin-based Global Public Policy Institute, the regime carried out 98% of chemical attacks. So take out the intervention question.
But
just
purely
what does it take for you to subscribe to that
evidence? The intervention question is the question that is central to us, the United States of America, and our leaders, and for me personally as a soldier. We just talked about how we were lied into going to war in Iraq. There was evidence that was presented saying Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction that he was going to give to al-Qaeda. This was the pretext for us to go to a war that ended up taking the lives of over 4,000 American troops.
But
so
one might argue that
I
there wasn't the same level of global consensus around those weapons of mass destruction as there has been around this use of chemical weapons.
Look, the bottom line is I do not take lightly having this skepticism and asking the tough questions before the use of our military force. So that is the central question here. The other issue that's at stake here that is not talked about in the media and that is misrepresented often in the media is the fact that the United States has had a very counterproductive role in Syria, where since 2011, The United States, both through the CIA, through covert and overt means, has been providing direct and indirect support to terrorist groups in Syria like Al-Qaeda. Why, one would ask? Why and how would that happen? Because that is a betrayal to every single service member. It's a betrayal to me as a soldier. It's a betrayal to us as Americans. It's because our leaders then in 2011 recognized that Al-Qaeda was the strongest fighting force on the ground who could take out the Assad government. So in this continuation of these ridiculous regime change war policies, leaders in our government made the decision to provide support to strengthen Al-Qaeda in order to topple the Assad government.
Okay, so
This is outrageous.
These are some pretty strong claims that you're making
about.
They're
not claims. They have been widely reported in the New York Times. They have been widely exposed, which is what ultimately ended up bringing the CIA program to an end.
And is this what led you to meet with the head of the Syrian regime in 2017?
This is what led me to introduce legislation before I ever went to Syria called the Stop Arming Terrorists Act. Because just as it is illegal for you or I to provide any support to any terrorist organization or group like Al-Qaeda, we'd be thrown in jail for it. Our government should be held to the same standard in how they're using our taxpayer dollars. I went to Syria to see firsthand and hear from the people there firsthand for myself, what they were experiencing, what they were going through. And my meeting with Assad, I went there and met with him when posed with the opportunity in the pursuit of peace and in the pursuit of national security.
And what is your, I want to get to a call, but just quickly, what is your reaction to other members of your party who were, really thought that meeting was out of line? I mean, Howard Dean called it abhorrent. I'm actually, that's
if
not
we,
quite the right word,
if,
but he if disapproved.
If we as leaders lack the courage to have meetings with adversaries or potential adversaries, then we will never have any hope of achieving peace or making sure that our people are safe.
So did you support the president's decision to meet with Kim Jong-un
absolutely.
In the DMZ?
Absolutely. This was something that I encouraged President Obama to do when he was in office and when President Trump was elected, encouraged him to do. We can't achieve peace if we're only willing to sit in the corner and meet with our friends and talk with those who we agree with. We see history rife with examples of, you know, Kennedy meeting with Khrushchev. With Reagan brokering this historic INF treaty with Gorbachev, Nixon meeting with Mao in China. This is the only way that we can achieve peace. And this is why it requires leadership with courage to be willing to take those meetings that unfortunately many others are unwilling to take. There's not a single other person running for president who had the courage to go and put their boots on the ground in Syria and see for themselves what was going on.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I want to get one more call.
Sure.
We are almost out of time. Jordana from Los Angeles, thanks for calling in. What's your thought for the Congresswoman?
Good afternoon, Congresswoman. I just want to ask, what is an ethical immigration policy going to look like going forward so we can really take that issue away from Republicans and neutralize them on this issue? It's so critical.
Thank you, Jordana. I appreciate this really important and timely question. First, you know, we've got to address the humanitarian crisis that's at the border, the atrocious conditions that we have children living in who have been ripped away from their parents, the extreme overcrowding in these detention facilities. In short, and I know we're running out of time here, really it talks about immediately ending these policies, immediately reuniting these kids with their families and recognizing that we need immigration reform to deal with these challenges. Reform that includes having safe and secure borders while also making sure that our immigration policy is humane, that those who are seeking asylum in this country are able to be met with the resources there, either at the border to make sure that their cases and requests are adjudicated quickly, but also changing our laws to make it possible for people to seek asylum from within their own country. So these folks are not forced to make that decision of putting their own lives at risk, their kids' lives at risk, walking over 1,000 miles, and we see how many people lose their lives in that journey and can instead put those requests in at our embassies or at our consulates in their home country. There's a great overhaul of our immigration policy that needs to be done to address the border crisis and how broken our legal immigration system is, and that's what I look forward to doing.
So, Congresswoman, on the election itself, you already know that back in February, you locked horns with NBC News and accused them of committing journalistic fraud after they published a report that English-language news sites employed by Russia in its 2016 election had been promoting your campaign. You said you actually expect further criticism and reports like this because you're views don't fully align with the overarching Democratic platform. Stepping back from that specific instance, how concerned are you about Russian meddling in this next election? And are we doing enough to prevent it?
I think we all have to be concerned about anyone who's trying to interfere in our democracy, who's trying to interfere with our elections. I think the biggest vulnerability that we have in our elections infrastructure, the biggest threat to our democracy is that we still have many states in this country who have no paper record of votes that are cast. This leaves that elections infrastructure, these electronic systems, vulnerable and open to any hacking attempts that will actually manipulate the votes that are cast and potentially change the outcome of an election.
So these paper records, you think, is an important thing that has to be
this
in place?
This is critical. It's critical. And I've introduced legislation called the Securing America's Elections Act that very simply would make sure that you're either using paper ballots, or if you're using an electronic system, that you have a voter-verified paper backup. So if there are any questions raised or any intelligence gathered about potential attempts to hack, then we have that ability to audit every single vote that's cast, verifying that by hand counting these paper ballots or the records to make sure that our elections are protected. We cannot afford for voters in this country to cast doubt upon whether or not their votes will actually be counted accurately in the way that they were cast. This is urgent and pressing, especially as we head into this next election next year that has huge consequences and very high stakes.
Listeners, that's Hawaii Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard. She's been with us here in the studio. She's running for president in 2020. Thank you so much for your time, Congresswoman.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, the U.S. women's soccer team wins a record fourth World Cup. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and the U.S. women's soccer team are world champions for the fourth time.
Go! U.S. leads!
That is the sound of team captain Megan Rapinoe scoring the game's first goal on a penalty kick in the 61st minute. Here to talk about the 2-0 win over the Netherlands and where the women's team goes from here is WBUR Sports and Society reporter Shira Springer. Hey, welcome back, Shira.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. So tell us first, what's your reaction to yesterday's game?
Shocked. No, not really.
I didn't think so.
I think we all expected the U.S. team to win to beat the Netherlands. They were the heavy favorites, and they did what they needed to do. Though I actually was a little shocked that they didn't score in the first half. We had to wait until the second half for the U.S. to get on the scoreboard.
Was the suspense killing you?
Oh, it was killing me.
Yeah.
But, they, you know, listen, it was an impressive run. And I think one of the things that everybody is saying after this is a team that talked the talk and then walked the walk. I mean, there's probably no greater example of that. They came in as heavy favorites. They were the Goliath. And they came through.
So to that Goliath thing, we actually talked just at the start of the tournament about this kind of Goliath narrative that the team embraced.
Mm-hmm.
The women's team came into the World Cup with tons of expectations. But really, how hard is it actually to win back-to-back World Cup championships?
Incredibly hard. Now, I will say this. The parity in the women's game isn't the same as the parity in the men's game. I think you can reasonably say that the tournament is maybe four, five, six teams deep on a good day. I mean, you had sort of the cream of the crop being, you know, France and England, of course, you know, in addition to the U.S., the Netherlands. Those were some of the, you know, Germany was up there as well. Those were the teams people were watching out for. But I think if you went beyond four, five, or six teams, there really wasn't much competition for the U.S.
Yeah.
But listen, there were record hot temperatures in France throughout the tournament.
Really?
There
were really like exactly, 110, 112.
Exactly. Yes. Not in where the games and not in the cities where the games were being played, but still hot enough to make substitution patterns an issue and player fatigue an issue and hydration an issue. And of course, injury is always an issue. So you've got to balance that all. It's all out. It's tough to get through a month-long tournament and still be in top four. And the U.S. managed to do that under the weight of expectations.
So Megan Rapinoe was in top form. She won the Golden Boot Award for the most goals scored and the Golden Ball, which is sort of like MVP. And at the age of 34, she became the oldest player to score in a Women's World Cup final. But apart from some big names like Rapinoe, like co-captain Alex Morgan, who were some of the other players that you really thought shined and had an impact?
Well, I think there's one name that comes through, and that's Rose Lavelle. She scored the other goal in the final against the Netherlands. She is the future of the women's national team. She's 24. She's an incredibly creative player, and she is going to lead the next generation of players, you know, the 20-somethings. You know, Rapinoe, as you mentioned, is 34. She's part of the 30-something group, a group that, you know, out of which many players will be retiring and not in the next World Cup. Rose Lavelle is the leader of the future. But can we stay with Megan Rapinoe just a bit?
Because you stay with Megan Rapinoe.
Because I think, you know, we should not gloss over the fact that she was so outspoken. She took on President Trump midway through the tournament. She was this
about the visit to the White House.
Exactly, about the visit to the White House. She had all this pressure on her. And quite frankly, a lot of naysayers and haters coming out of the woodwork throughout the tournament, particularly when she took on Trump. And she sort of just brushed it all off. And when the pressure was at its highest, she came through. I mean, she scored critical goal after critical goal for this team. And not only that, she led them on and off the field and maintained her outspokenness and didn't let any of the pressure bother her. I mean, one of the all-time great pressure performances at the highest level.
Really, truly cool under pressure. Now, there was one other really interesting moment from yesterday I want to make sure we get to. It was at the end of the game where the crowd started an equal pay chant. Let's listen to that.
Equal pay! Equal pay! Equal pay!
Now, against the backdrop of this tournament, the women's team is suing their employer, the U.S. Soccer Federation, saying that they're paid less than the men's team. They receive less support despite really consistent success. So what is the status of that lawsuit?
Well, along with the celebration, the U.S. women's team gets to head to mediation. That's the next step. And I think the hope is they avoid a messy trial and sort of can resolve this in some equitable fashion and come to an agreement where there is equal pay. Personally, I think the women should get paid more. We are talking about the most successful women's team in the history of the sport and a men's team, quite frankly, that has done nothing.
But there are times when they get paid more. Is that correct?
Yes, but that only happens when they have the highest level of success possible. They have to win World Cup after World Cup after World Cup. You know, they have to win game after game in between the World Cup, in between World Cups to even come remotely close to earning what the men get. Who have a much weaker record. And not only that, you know, we are not even factoring in, I know this isn't part of, you know, the U.S. Soccer Federation's purview, but club pay too. I mean, the men make much more than the women do in club pay.
So before we go, I want to shift gears for just a second because I am a big tennis fan. And it was really fun to watch 15-year-old tennis phenom Coco Gauff over the last several days at Wimbledon. Now, she lost today against Simona Halep in the fourth round, but she caught the attention of the world in round one by beating her idol, Venus Williams. How did she get so far so young, and are we going to see more from her in the future?
I'll answer the second question first, which is, of course, yes, we are definitely going to see more of her in the future. This is a future Grand Slam winner. I don't think there's any doubt, particularly if you saw her not in today's match, but over the weekend. She was down, she was almost out, and she came back, forced a third set, then won in the third set. So I think she has not only the physical skill, but the mental fortitude to be a superstar in women's tennis. So how did she get here? Well, it's interesting. I've been listening and reading some of what her parents have said, and they had a 10-year plan for her to win a Grand Slam. And she is 7 years into that 10-year plan.
Oh, man, so three more years to go.
Exactly.
All right, that's WBUR Sports and Society reporter Shira Springer. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, stay with us, listeners. Coming up, what does summer camp mean to you and your family? We'll take your calls. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It's that time of year for many kids and parents. It is summer camp time.
Is it worth $1,000 a week?
It sure is. It's the best darn camp there is.
Well, how do you justify $1,000 a week?
Well, we have some special programs. We're doing Shakespeare in the Round again this year, of course. Our political roundtable, Henry Kissinger, will appear.
It's amazing.
And the kids wanted animals, so this year each camper will stalk and kill his own bear at our private wildlife preserve.
That's incredible.
What do you expect for $1,000 a week?
That is, of course, a scene from the 1979 camp classic Meatballs, starring Bill Murray. A lot has changed in summer camps since then, and some hasn't. For the rest of the show today, we're going to be discussing summer camps. How have they changed? What are your experiences? What does summer camp mean to you and your family, listeners? Do you find it affordable? And do you have memories of camp you'd like to share? Call us. Tell us your thoughts at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Joining us in studio is Chris Smith. He is the president and executive director of Boston After School and Beyond, which is a nonprofit focused on summer learning. Chris, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
Also with us on the line from New Hampshire is Nick Teich, the CEO and founder of Harbor Camps, which runs a number of summer camps, including Camp Aeronautic for transgender and non-binary youth. Nick, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let me start with the two of you. What does summer camp mean to each of you, Chris?
Summer was about making new friends and learning, though we didn't necessarily know it when we went through it. And now we see that that learning is being made explicit across the board because, of course, learning does not stop at school. And actually, the jokes made in that Meatballs movie are actually coming to the fore. Kids are doing really interesting things, from learning to sail, building boats, urban gardening, all sorts of great activities that help them learn.
So it was kind of striking. I know it's supposed to be a joke, but policy roundtables, that kind of thing, may not be so far afield.
Not at all. Kids are designing business plans. They're creating projects that are helping their communities. They're really putting their skills to use, practicing them, applying them. And the result is that they are more ready for the next school year.
Nick, how about you? Oh, sorry, Chris. Nick, how about you? What does summer camp mean to you?
For me, it really means community, building community, and making friends and making those bonds that for me have lasted a lifetime from my camp days, but also for the kids to just be able to be who they are and be themselves in a way that they really can't be outside of camps, particularly for the kids that attend our camps.
Nick, your camp is in its 10th year. What was your inspiration for it, and what were you hoping to accomplish when you launched it?
Yeah, that's true. We launched it 10 years ago, and my thought was camp is such a great overnight summer camp, and we're an overnight camp, is such a great medium to give kids the freedom and flexibility and independence away from their parents or caregivers, and also a place for them to really find themselves and be themselves and have fun. I had a great camp experience as a kid, and I also realized that transgender youth in particular would not be able to have the same camp experience as many other kids. A lot has changed in the last 10 years for the good, but it's still mainly that way. And so that was, for me thinking about how could I be a camp professional and what could I do? Also being transgender, this obviously felt close to home for me. And then at around the same time that I was thinking about this, I was asked not to come back to a camp that felt like, because I was trans, I couldn't be a good role model for the kids. And so I was told, I would not be welcome back at that camp, which was a charity camp that I was volunteering at the time as an adult. And so it really made me think, how can these kids be enjoying camp experiences? And it turns out many of them weren't. So that was the start of Camp Aeronautic, and our other populations followed that, just to have a place where they could be themselves and just be kids and feel like typical kids.
Listeners, we're talking with our guests about summer camp, how it's changed, what's important for kids in summer camp. We want to hear from you about your experiences, what you value, and what's on your mind. Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Jeff from Westford on the line. Jeff, tell us your thoughts. Jeff, do we still...
Nutrition class.
Jeff, just start Hello. Again. We had a little trouble hearing you there. Just start again for us.
Oh, that's okay. I teach a fishing camp in Westford, Massachusetts, through the Marcus Lewis Day Camp. And there are still traditions that are alive and well, and I believe that our camp is evolving over the course and changes of the climate and the times. Your earlier caller had mentioned some things that are certainly within our realm of how we have to take care and maintain kids, and it's alive and well.
And what's an important fishing tradition from your camp that has stayed with you over the years, Jeff?
Well, it's the excitement of seeing a young kid catch their first fish. There is no greater joy than to see them get excited and be engaged, and at that point you have their full attention. And you at that point have the ability to mold and shape and create a memory that will cast lifelong stories and bring them back to the camp someday to teach and be counselors. And that's generally the way that the tradition works. They come to camp, they age out, they become counselors, and then they go out into the real world with some real good experiences.
Jeff, thanks so much for that call, that generational experience. First you go to the camp, then you become a counselor. Leslie from Lexington, tell us what's on your mind about camp.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I agree with all the comments so far and wanted to add a few to my own that will hopefully broaden some people's understanding about summer camp and what it can be. First of all, it's not always just fun in the woods. It can be about changing lives. I'm the volunteer president of the board of directors for Agassiz Village, which is a nonprofit camp, which, you know, many of the kids from Greater Boston that are most underserved attend and have over the last 80 years. And at Agassiz, we're teaching social-emotional learning skills as well as swimming and climbing and sports skills, tools that are just going to help them make better decisions in life and get through their lives. And second, I just wanted to comment that I think it can be really easy to send kids, your kids particularly, to homogeneous camps where, like, the kids look like your kids and they come from backgrounds like yours. But, you know, alternatively, it can be an opportunity to experience diversity in a true way, where your kids could learn from other kids and broaden their experience and make friends that they, you know, may not have the opportunity to meet in their school year.
Leslie, thanks so much for that. Listeners, do keep calling at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. What's the importance of summer camp in a child's life? Chris Smith of Boston After School and Beyond, I saw you nodding a lot as Leslie was talking. So what was resonating for you in that?
I mean, Leslie articulated perfectly the power and the promise of a great summer experience. And it doesn't just have to be a camp. In Boston, we work with 160 programs from the Harbor Islands to the Blue Hills, but they also include college campuses, workplaces, and community nonprofits in between. What they have in common is that kids get connected to other kids whom they might not have met otherwise, to caring adults and teachers in new settings, and to a set of skills and experiences that will lead to quantifiable outcomes in many cases. But to me, it's more important the incalculable benefits of coming away with a sense of curiosity and a sense of confidence.
And let's add to that, Nick Teich, what about just the joy of childhood and our old, you know, either memories or if you never went to camp, you certainly saw the movies of fun and relaxation and play. How important is that to a child's development as well?
For us, it's very important. We have a lot of kids who are, you know, they're going to therapy a lot. They're having to talk about their gender or their, for our dwarfism camp, for instance, their, you know, just their stature or why are they, you know, why do they have skeletal dysplasia or why are they trans or why are they this gender or that gender? And so it gives, camp gives them a place to relax where they don't have to answer those questions and they can just find new friends, people that are different from them but like them in many ways. In really important and deep ways. So for our particular camp, relaxing and having fun is really important because it's something that our kids do not get a lot of back in their home communities, you know, just due to a lot of teasing that they encounter or bullying or just questions, you know, what is it like to be like you? So for us, having them canoeing and swimming and doing archery and making these really deep bonds with people that are like them and understanding them is hugely life-changing, and it really instills confidence and resilience, we hope. And it's just done with your very traditional camp activities. So for us, that, you know, that's what works particularly. And it's so great that there are so many different kinds of summer camp programs around to fit each and every kid.
So we've talked now about the social emotional skills, the diversity that you can be exposed to, the curiosity and adventure, and also just the need to be a kid, which is wonderful, but it comes at a cost. Chris, there's no question summer programs can be really expensive. So what help is there for families to afford some of these programs?
Boston has embraced summer learning as a public policy priority. Mayor Walsh and incoming Superintendent Brenda Caselius launched what's now called the fifth quarter of learning, so that kids in the Boston Public Schools and other public schools get priority access to these camps free of charge. In fact, they've gone so far as to end the traditional summer school and make it this more enriching model of summer learning.
So the old days of the stuffy classroom is gone, and kids instead for free get to do what?
Well, they get to sail, they get to learn tennis, they get to do arts, and they combine it with academics with their teacher. So rather than go to be assigned to summer school and miss out on all that great enrichment, which has untold benefits down the line, they get to combine them.
So that comes to a term that our listeners may or may not have heard of, which is this concept of the summer slide, the idea that there's learning loss over a summer and that that can be compounded for low-income kids. What is the role in this model of summer learning to help with the summer slide, and how real is that summer slide?
There's a debate about just how real the summer slide is, but what's not debatable at this point is that low-income kids learn less than their wealthier peers. So our efforts are focused on getting kids who otherwise wouldn't find their way to these experiences into the experiences. We were part of a national study over the last few years with the Wallace Foundation and RAND that showed that kids who participated at a high rate, so at least 80% of the scheduled days over 5 weeks, actually outperformed their non-participating peers in English, math, and social-emotional skills.
So, Nick, we've heard about the importance of kids having access to this kind of programming to improve their intellectual, social, emotional skills. According to the American Camp Association, a week-long sleepaway camp cost on average about $800. That was back in 2015, so it's going to be higher than that now. And that was up from $400 in 2005. So that's more than doubling of the cost probably by now. How do harbor camps, your camps, think about affordability?
So this is really important to us because the populations we serve come from all different walks of life. We have summer camps that typically people are in a certain population and they know us or they become aware of us as a resource rather than people who have sent their family members to camps for generations and just figure it's the next thing they're going to do. So we do get a lot of campers who otherwise probably wouldn't have thought about summer camp, which means that it might not be affordable to them. So for us, we raise a lot of money each year for scholarships and financial aid, and we take as many kids as, you know, are a good fit for our program until we're full, and then we raise the money. So we do it in sort of a need-blind way where we don't have a cap on what our scholarship or financial aid might be. It's just whoever needs to come, you know, if they can show us their need, then we will find donors to take care of the money. You know, sometimes that includes, we have kids who come from all over the world. We have several kids from other countries. We have kids from all over the U.S. and Canada. So we do have kids who we pay for their tuition plus airfare, for instance, if they really, you know, don't have any means to help themselves get to us. You know, we'll find a way for that to happen.
You'll make sure that it happens.
Right, yeah. Right. So very important.
Listeners, what programs have worked for you, for your children? What has worked well? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Casey from Quincy, thanks for calling in. What's on your mind?
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to also talk about, like, overnight sports camps
and the value of being away with the team and learning how to compromise and do different types of activities with each other that don't necessarily involve the sport or a classroom or necessarily a structured environment. I think it's really important for competitive teams to spend time away so that they can learn, you know, each other's strengths and weaknesses, build a relationship, and that way you can play better as a team, and then later on in life work better with people. So I think sports camps are really important, which is nice.
Thanks for that call, Casey. Chris, Casey's telling us about life skills that in her case she got specifically from a team sports camp. What skills are kids needing today that maybe 10 years ago they didn't need, that they're either not getting at home or they're not getting in the classroom, that it's really important for summer programs to help them with?
Yeah, I appreciate her comments, because whether it's sports, arts, other sorts of activities, they're really a lens for learning these skills. And these are skills that can be taught, learned, and improved. Skills like creativity, critical thinking, collaboration and working in teams, perseverance. What do you do when you initially fail? How do you get back in the game? How do you manage yourself and your time and your goals? So these skills have to be practiced. And a lot of these summer programs are really ideal environments to do so. They're structured, they're supportive, they're challenging at times, and that's where the learning comes in. And it turns out that these skills are really valued in not only school, but also college and careers. Just ask any HR manager looking to hire somebody or an admissions officer what they're looking for. These are the types of skills that kids will use all the way through life. And I like the idea of being able to draw on a summer experience or a memory and to think about the skills you developed, how you entered a new learning environment, how you learned to adjust it, you overcame what was then a barrier, or you thought it was a barrier, and to apply that to new challenges in life. That's the idea.
So Nick Teich, CEO and founder of Harbor Camps, there's so much going on in a potential child's day around camp, even if they're doing simple things. It strikes me, I mean, you're living up there. This is a long haul. It's got to be exhausting, and there has to be something that makes you want to get up every morning and engage with what I think you have about 150 kids at a given time there.
Yes.
So what?
And I don't.
Yeah. Go ahead. No. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say I don't have to get up because I don't sleep.
but to the point.
And finding a quiet place to do this was very difficult. But you know, it's just the energy. I mean, the kids are. It's energizing. It's adrenaline. It's not something I think I could sustain 12 months of the year. But the fact that the rest of the year I'm, you know, meeting campers, getting campers to come, we're hiring staff, we're doing, you know, fundraising for these kids. And then my, you know, all of our staff when we're here are just so energized by the kids and seeing them light up and seeing them try something for the first time and seeing them make friends. I've never met another kid like me before, and now I have a friend for life, or 8 friends for life. You know, seeing them say goodbye to their parents and being sad, and then an hour later, you know, they've already made something. It is hard not to be energized by that, and it's just the community. It's amazing. I mean, I've always loved overnight camp, and I think I just never wanted to not be there. So I found a way to make it my career.
So when it's over, though, do you like go crawl into a hole and sleep for 2 weeks? Or
yes, that's exactly what I do.
That makes sense. All right, well, let's look ahead now. So we've talked a little bit about, you know, Chris, one of the things that struck me is that the city of Boston told the Globe that there are now 14,000 students participating in city-sponsored summer programs. That's a huge increase over the last 10 years, is it not?
It's a very big increase. It started with just a handful 10 years ago. It's grown. And these programs are really working together to get better, to make sure that they're serving kids who otherwise wouldn't be served. And, you know, it's interesting. I think we're at a point now where high-quality summer learning shouldn't just be an accident of birth if your family can afford it or rely on heroic fundraising efforts like Nick's, but they should really be an expectation of a good education. And we're seeing the city and school districts increasingly take that on because they recognize the value of this type of learning, which is a little different from learning in school. And in fact, this happens to be National Summer Learning Week. We're celebrating it on Wednesday at the Charlestown Navy Yard at Courageous Sailing, where we're going to see a sailing demonstration of kids. So this is all heading, I think, in the right direction as we collect these anecdotes, as the research catches up with what's obvious and intuitive to any of us who have seen a kid benefit from this type of program.
Excellent. And Nick, just in, you know, a few seconds, what's the next big step in camp from your perspective? Maybe something that you dream of being able to offer kids one day.
I love what we're doing right now, but I would say that camp in general is becoming more important because of the technology addiction that our society has, and any kids being able to be away from that, and at our particular camp and many overnight camps, they are away from it. It gives them the face-to-face friendship making that is hard to emulate outside of camp, and that's really important.
That's great. That was Nick Teich on the line from New Hampshire. He's the CEO and founder of Harbord Camps, which runs a number of summer programs. Thank you for joining us, Nick.
Thank you.
Chris Smith, Executive Director of Boston After School and Beyond, thanks for joining us, too.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.